This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith about mathematics and spirituality with Professor Klaus Witz from the University of Illinois. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks.
Good
Steve.
To have you here. And tell me how... I'd like to find out eventually how you got interested in this topic, but let's find out a little bit about your background. How long have you been teaching here at the university?
Oh, forever.
How many years?
Oh, some 40-some years, something 40 like
some
that.
Years. And where did you study before coming to U of I?
At the University of North Carolina.
At Chapel Hill.
Right.
Uh-huh. And what was your field of study there?
I got a PhD in math, in mathematics.
And when you came here, you started teaching math in the...
Yes, I was in the math department.
Math department. And then tell us about your very interesting career path.
Well, I went into math, you know, not really for math's sake. I went into math so that I could understand physics. And actually, that was my second choice. I first wanted to study consciousness. What is consciousness and what is... But I couldn't do that, so I started studying... I thought physics knew something about reality. I thought consciousness had to do with reality. So I got a PhD in math. I started teaching here and so on. And after 7-8 years, you know, I realized... that I really did not want to do math anymore. I wanted to understand the mind that did math, so to speak, and the mind that did science and so on. So I started investigating really how kids thought, kids' cognition, like Piaget-type stuff, except using videotape and audio tape. And so I gradually got transferred into the College of Education and... At first, I taught there a lot of the statistics courses because I was trained in mathematics.
Of course.
So I could do statistics. But then I really, you know, I really realized that I really got into spirituality. That was in my middle and late, my late 30s, I guess, my 37 or so. And pretty soon I started going to India as a spiritual teacher. And so then I started working on a book on the Upanishads. I published a book on the Upanishads. I learned Sanskrit and so on. And that book was finished in 93. So starting in 93, I started teaching qualitative research methods in the College of Education. And so then, you know, those old interests, then I remembered basically... This is how I got to this project, math and spirituality. That when I was in the math department, you know, really a lot of people, my colleagues, I felt most of my colleagues were very fulfilled people. Of course, there were the pressures of publishing and being original and proving things.
And getting tenure.
And getting tenure.
Minor things like that.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a tremendous amount of fulfillment.
A lot of satisfaction that you saw in other professors of mathematics.
Yes.
Yes.
And so since I was dealing with in the Department of Curriculum Instruction, which is where I was teaching, where I wound up teaching, we, you know, train teachers. It's one of the big jobs of the department, teacher training. And so... I started a project, you know, with a cohort that we had, the mathematics teachers. But I really wanted to find out what is it that made people fulfilled. What did they get? Why did they get interested in math? What was the attraction? You know, what was going on? And then why did they get fulfilled? And I was particularly interested in higher-level math, like undergraduate level, because there's a... big division between high school math and so on and, you know, high level math.
So you started studying college students and how they, what kind of fulfillment they achieved in studying high-level math.
Well, yes and no. Because it turned out that the education students, they were math majors.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to be high school teachers or middle school teachers in math.
I see.
But many of them really didn't want to have anything to do with higher math.
Okay.
You know, in fact, the great majority of them, only like 20% or less than that, were really interested in higher math.
So most of them wanted to study the kind of math they'd be teaching.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I started also interviewing graduate students in math, like advanced graduate students in math. And I started in, I also found an undergraduate who was really, you know, a hotshot person, a very good mind and so on. I didn't know whether he was going to go into math, but I, you know, started making interviews anyway. And I also made interviews with a few other people, either graduate students in math, virtually all graduate students in math except one who was a graduate student in math education, a PhD student in math education.
So you began this study, and your original question was, your questions were about consciousness, and then you got involved in spirituality, particularly in your study in India with your spiritual teacher there, and all these things kind of came together in this study, is that right?
No, the study was just something that I could do to where I could bring my understanding of spirituality to bear.
Ah, okay. Well, tell us how you did that.
In-depth interviews, and they get transcribed, and you leave at least 2 weeks space between the interviews so that you can digest the interview, and then you can sort of, you know, figure out what do I need to pursue in the next interview. So it's a cumulative thing.
How many interviews would you end up doing?
With
one person?
With one person, very often 6 or 7.
How long would each be?
An hour.
Wow. That's a lot of time.
And very focused. And the interviewing approach was completely novel because I was going only on the basis of the person's inspiration. In other words, you know, why was that person inspired to go into teaching? What made him do that, you know? And what, in fact, how did that person find a direction in life?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then how did mathematics play into that? How was math, going into math, part of that? So it was really I mostly went on the basis of stuff that they brought up on their own, not, you know, asking questions. And now, of course, I had to cover I had to understand the situation completely of that person at the time, the objective situation, personality, family, upbringing, everything. But really, the focus was mostly those deeper issues.
So when you're having these interviews with these graduate students who are in mathematics, trying to decide how they found their direction in life, what was it about mathematics that attracted them and
exactly.
excited them and gave them fulfillment,
yeah.
You had 6 or 7 hours with each one. They were giving a huge portion of their life to you.
Yeah, that was over a period of 2 years usually, something like that.
Okay. And they were willing to share with you about their deepest feelings
that
and thoughts?
That is part of the approach, because, the approach now, you know, I'm publishing papers on it or whatnot. The approach is called the participant is ally. In other words, you tell the person that you are, in fact, you have to mean it, of course, that you are into that. I think that this is an important issue. And, you know, I would like their help. So I'm in it for a higher cause. And this usually they talk about, they accept that, and that becomes part of their own. I mean, they try to do everything.
Now, so they come to trust you.
They come, yeah, of course. Trust, and of course, each student gets written up, each person interviewed should get written up in form of a portrait. The construction of the portrait is incredibly labor intensive, because I give long sections of paragraphs, and you have to get the essence of what the person is saying in the paragraph as a whole. So very often I also give some indications. He says it in this kind of a voice and stuff like that.
Awesome.
So everything that you say has to be, really completely in tune with all the nuances that you hear on the tapes and in those expressions.
Well, let's give our listeners a little insight into some of the things you've learned from this study.
Well, my main subjects, my four main subjects, were the people that went on to get a PhD. In all four cases, so three of them were fourth and fifth year graduate students, and one of them was this undergraduate. In all cases, it became clear that at some point, either in a course in college, in the university, in college, or even already in a course in high school, if it was a good high school, they started seeing something higher in mathematics. And then when that hit, very often it was, for example, the person would see something in a topology course, and then she would realize, this is the essence. This is what we are doing in math. And then she would generalize it to all of math.
Wow.
So all four portraits have that character. And there is this recognition of something higher. And very often, beauty is a big part. Truth, the importance of math for its own sake, all of those kinds of things. Math as a high activity. One of my subject had an instantaneous God experience. Everything, the form of every pattern we see is Christ. Well, he was not, on a spiritual path. But, that stayed in him. Several years later, he converted to Catholicism, and math to him now is like a sacred activity. There's another person for whom math is a sacred activity, two of my subjects. So the general story, although the individual stories are extremely different mathematical subjects, and the personalities and the fates very different. Two of them dropped out of college, out of university for a while, and had to get themselves back together and so on. But once they saw, there's a higher aspect in math. Once they got an inner vision, so to speak, an inner understanding. Forget about vision, just an inner understanding that there was more there, then that, gave, your listeners can't see the motions I'm making, but that gave
they can hear them.
Direction to their life. They got their trip together, and they got their life together, and they, on the spot, they decided they would go to graduate school. Hmm. In one case, maybe that was not the cause, but in three other cases.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon on this warm January, unusually warm January day, with Professor Klaus Witz. His first name is spelled with a K, and the last name is W-I-T-Z. He's been a professor here in the Department of Mathematics and in the College of Education, and has taught math education and curriculum and instruction, and recently has been doing a study on the spiritual aspirations that come from looking from the study of mathematics, connected to the study of mathematics. And a recent book of his has just come out on that, that's just published last month by Edwin Mellon. And if you have questions, we encourage our listeners to be part of these conversations. And particularly today, I'm eager to have callers because my voice is barely hanging on because I made the mistake of cheering at the Illinois basketball game earlier today and booing the terrible refs and that sort of thing. So if you can call with a good question, I'd be delighted. The number's here in the studio. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, if you're listening, perhaps on the internet, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Now, I have to report that if you're listening outside of the continental U.S., you cannot call us free. Sorry about that, and I do know we have listeners all around in surprising places in the world, and the Internet makes all that possible. So, but if you're in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-9455 with a question for our guest, Professor Witz. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And I'll try to keep my hoarse voice going as long as I can here, but do call with a comment or question. Tell us a little bit about the kind of spirituality that you discovered in these in-depth interviews where you, these grad students you were talking with really did become allies and opened up to you about their thoughts and feelings, ideas. Your background, as you said, you published books on Hindu spirituality. You studied in India with a spiritual advisor, a leader. What's your own religious background?
Well, all this is long stories, of course. I grew up Protestant, but I didn't really have, I never, you know, until I was 18 or 19, I couldn't understand what was going on with Jesus, why he had to be crucified and stuff like that. And I really didn't understand the, we memorized Luther's catechism and so on, but you know, I couldn't understand. And the people that I talked to, ministers, Baptist ministers and so on, they couldn't get through to me, right? So I basically shelved everything and said, I will worry about this, you know, later when I understand more. But then, you know, after I left the math department, I was studying cognition, how kids thought about the world, how they understand the world, and at all age levels, really. And so gradually I started realizing the importance of consciousness and stuff like that. And so around when I was like 37, various things happened, and I ran into I started some projects on consciousness, talking to people about meditation and talking about, you know, artists about how they did art and this kind of stuff. And around 37, I ran into a hippie guru. Was like a peacemaker. He was one of the, you know, original, one of the rainbow people, actually. A very incredibly colorful person.
Where did you meet him?
In Oregon, huh. In communes in Oregon. Huh. He was a commune builder and so on. But he was the first person that I saw that really had gotten rid of all the you know, not so great aspects of one's personality, anger and stuff like that. There was not one bad thought in him about other people and stuff like that, you know. So simply just seeing that for the first time really made a huge impression.
Now I'm sometimes skeptical when I hear reports like that. How long of a time did you spend with him? Some people can be very good, but for only short times.
No, he's... At that time, the only way he could get through to me was to become my subject, my participant. So I interviewed him also and made tapes and so on. I spent several periods of 2 weeks or 3 weeks with him, something like that, over a 2 or 3 year period. And through him, really, seeing a selfless person who, he was like a devotee of unconditional love. Well, you know, 5 years after he became a devotee of unconditional love, he also became a devotee of God. He says, Klaus, you have to make a decision. Are you also going to go for God, or are you just going to be devotee of unconditional love, and so on? And so he was, and through him, you know, just I realized he had become like a 5-year-old in some ways. He had his mind under complete control. I mean, really, absolutely amazing control that I don't know any other person here. He used to be a vagabond and a peacemaker. He participated in the riots and he would calm the crowds down and stuff like that. So he was going up and down the deserts of Nevada and whatnot. And he said, he told me, you know, Klaus, I had a little copy of the New Testament with Jesus' words in red. And I can tell you, I practiced, that's all he read, the Jesus' words in red. And in fact, that's what I recommend to everybody also. And he said, I can tell you, I practiced every one of those words to the letter, you know. So he started his path like that when he was like 21. I met him when he was in his early 40s or middle 40s, something like that. So just seeing a person that there was this kind of thing, completely given to God, to goodness and stuff like that. He was a healer and all this kind of stuff. That stopped me. Totally innocent. No trying to get something out of you or trying to persuade you. I mean, anything.
He wasn't after your money?
No. So I decided, you know, I had to find out more about this because that was not within the range of my experience. So I went to India. And so since then, I've been going to India like every 2 or 3 years for a time, and now every year, last several years.
And what kind of spiritual practices are you involved in India?
Well, my teacher basically advocates all religions. He just says, you know, just practice your religion to the utmost. And, you know, he feels that, I mean, he says all religions. But in terms of practice, I can tell you the first thing I practiced in 78, which is the second time I went there, you know, I decided, what should I practice? And because I was completely committed to truth, with a capital T. I felt there was reality somewhere, but I have no way. I thought maybe by finding out about cognition, how the mind works, how people felt and so on, I could find out. But I really, you know, didn't. So I decided I would practice do good, be good, see good. That was my level.
In that order?
In that order. The hardest is see good because it means see only good, right?
So I'm a little confused. Your first guru in Oregon said, remember the words of Jesus, read the Bible in red.
No, he didn't say that.
He didn't. He said that's what he did.
That's what he did.
Right. Okay, but you like that idea.
Now all the religions live in me, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
For example, when I came back in 78 from India, I decided I had to read, you know, religions. So I started in the stacks every day. I spent like 3 hours. We have a wonderful library. I spent 3 hours finding, you know, the scriptures and saints. And I read all religions. And it became very clear very quickly that they're all in the same direction.
Well, let me push you a little bit on that.
Sure.
All of them. Now, I can remember some religions I've studied, like the one that, say, Jim Jones ended up taking people to Guyana and 800
yes.
people committed suicide thinking that people were out to get them. I'm not sure that religion is the same as other religions
I
know.
But this was an offshoot, I guess, from Christianity.
Yes,
right?
It was.
Now,
yeah.
I'm talking about, you know, people that are connected with scriptures and with saints and that are trying to put that into practice.
Okay. I once went to the Parliaments of World Religions in South Africa.
Oh, yes.
And there was no entry requirement.
Right.
Any person who felt they were religious could go. And there were about 7,000 people there. And my wife and I ran across one couple where they had formed their own religion. And the man worshipped the woman. It seemed odd to us.
Well, yeah, sure. No, I'm talking about, you know, the basic religions.
Okay.
I'm also, you know, I think religions of non-literate people are going in the same direction.
Uh-huh. Well, let's talk about a couple of those. For example, the program that follows this one, This American Life, was broadcast yesterday as well. And one of the stories on that program will be about a Muslim child in America who was persecuted for being Muslim by probably Christian kids.
Yes.
How do you resolve those kind of fights between religions, whether it's on the child level or older?
If this is a situation that I need to deal with directly in one way or another, then certainly I will deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, you know, basically all the religions are trying to uplift the human condition.
Okay. We have a caller who wants to join our conversation, I think. Well, I'm not sure. Yes. Let's see if we can get this. Can you hear me? Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Ah, yes. Go ahead with your question for Professor Klaus Witz.
Yes, one book of God is Paul Erdős's book of all the best proofs in mathematics. I was wondering if you know about that.
I don't know this particular book, but I certainly quote Erdős as a person who had a deeply, you know, who was totally impacted by the spiritual nature of math. Erdős said, for example, that mathematics is the only infinite activity, you know, that he's... And, in fact, I quoted the obituary on Erdős that was published by Joel... Somebody in the Courant Institute. And he said, you know, he explained, really... that for many people, mathematics is like religion. You know, he says to explain to the integer. In fact, he quoted Kronecker. He said, you know, the integers were made by God, and all else, all the other mathematical structures, the hundreds of fields that have grown up since then, and analysis and so on, are all the work of man. But so I do think, I definitely think that Erdős, I have not studied Erdős in detail. I have read a biography of his by Hoffman, and so that's mostly what I know. And I looked at a couple of his papers. That's about it.
Well, he basically conjectured that God had a book of all the best proofs in mathematics. So whenever somebody came up with a particularly good proof, for example, Euclid's proof that the primes are infinite, perhaps you could mention that proof. You would say that would be a book proof, and that it was in God's book of the best mathematics. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call.
Well, okay. What I would say is, you know, to him, that had a very... to find the best proof had a very special and powerful and deep meaning. In other words, there was a deeper reality to the best proof. That's why he was after the best proofs. Knowing what I know about Erdős, that's why he was after the best proofs. So doing that is like, you know, an attempt of his to get closer to God.
We're talking about mathematics and spirituality today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the Department of Communications here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, a listener-supported radio service. We are eager to have listeners join in and ask good questions, like the last caller. If you have a call, 333-9455, we'll get our studio here and our technical engineer, Matt Kessler, will answer the phone and get you in line to talk with our guest today. If it's a long-distance call, do use 1-800-222-9455. So Champaign-Urbana area, if it's a local call, 333-9455. Keeping the Faith is sponsored in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y has been on this campus for 134 years now. Some of the programs we have at the Y at 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right across from Lincoln Hall, include Communiversity, non-credit classes for people in the area who would like to learn something or teach something, and we have classes starting up in late January and early February. I'll be teaching one of those courses on the writings of C.S. Lewis, an English writer of the last century. We'll be looking at some of his apologetic writings as well as some of his fiction for children, the Narnia stories, and maybe even a science fiction book or so. So if you're interested in that particular course, or any of the other courses, they'll be listed online at the University Y website very shortly. That's universityymca.org, and then look for Communiversity. The class I'm teaching will be on Thursday nights, and we already know that there are so many classes at the Y, I'm going to have to teach mine at my home. So people who want to read C.S. Lewis a bit and talk about him, do sign up for that course. You'll need to find a way to get to my house south of Urbana. But we'll help you find a ride if you need a carpool. Other things at the Y, Friday Forum will be starting up at the end of January, and the last Friday in January, and Know Your University the last Tuesday in January. And I'll have more information about those programs and speakers coming up very soon. At this time of the year, a lot of college students are still off on vacation, but there are about 120 or so who have volunteered to do a service project this week through the University YMCA. They've gone off to 8 or 9 different places across the country, from Texas to North Carolina to New York City to other places. Minneapolis, Minnesota, to do a service project. This is called Alternative Spring Break, although we now have these service projects in winter break, fall break, and summer break, as well as spring break. Over 350 students total will be involved doing these service projects, and we're very, very delighted that students will take their vacation time to go and help somebody else and, of course, learn in the process and become friends with other students who are on those trips. 12 students go in two different vans and raise most of the money themselves to make those trips, and we're delighted to have been a sponsor of this kind of activity on this campus for the last 25 years or so. Coming up on WIL Radio this week, there are a couple programs in particular that listeners to Keeping the Faith might want to know about. On January 7th, David Inge, that's tomorrow at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking with John DiIulio about the U.S. Constitution and whether America was founded as a Christian nation or not. DiIulio was the first director of the White House Office on Faith-Based Initiatives, and he left somewhat disappointed with that activity, and he's currently professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. And we'll be talking with David Inge on Focus 580 right here on the radio tomorrow, a little bit after 11 o'clock. And later in the week, on Tuesday, the Afternoon Magazine will feature Beth Wenger, W-E-N-G-E-R, who's the professor of Jewish history at the University of Pennsylvania, and she'll be talking about the Jewish Americans, three centuries of Jewish voices in America. That's Tuesday afternoon with Celeste Quinn on Afternoon Magazine. Well, let's get back to our guest today. And again, I encourage listeners to give us a call. If you have a comment or question, perhaps you were a student of Professor Klaus Witz in your time here at the university. Be happy to have you, any of you call and tell him about what you're doing these days. My name is Steve Shoemaker. Let's go on and talk about spirituality and mathematics. Now, Klaus, I was never very good at math. The last I ever took was college algebra. Would I be able to understand your book on spiritual aspirations connected with math?
Sure.
So it's a general book.
The book focuses on their experience and their inspiration, and therefore, and you know, the spirituality is worked out on the basis from that.
And the subtitle of your book is The Experience of American University Students. Is this the smallest study ever published where you only had, what, four people you interviewed?
Well, see, the very good question. Actually, the book is over 400 pages. Each person gets maybe a 40-page portrait.
I see.
And now, there are also two portraits of two undergraduates in there. And one is a young woman. And both of them are becoming math high school teachers,
okay,
and or middle school high school teachers. Now, one of them is inspired by math, even though it is just high school math. And, in fact, the inspiration is completely spiritual. Hmm. Like math, it will all come together. It will all make a... It's part of her conception of the unity of knowledge. And the unity of knowledge, when there's unity of knowledge, there will be unity of mankind, you know. So, and that's an incredibly alive way of being in her, which is brought out and worked out in detail. The other person, you know, he just discovered, he started working a lot in high school, in his school, and he realized that he had some, you know, leadership abilities, and he decided, at first he was interested in math, but then, you know, then he started having interest like, I really want to work in a school and improve the whole system in some kind of a leadership capability. In fact, he is now, you know, principal or something like that, vice principal. And she is a middle school, incredibly fulfilled middle school teacher.
That's hard to even imagine, thinking of middle school kids she has to work with. Let me jump back to her a minute. When you talk about her being motivated by the spiritual quality of a unity of knowledge, which she hopes or thinks, believes will be, may lead to a unity of people, does that mean that you and she believe there's one truth, or do you think there are many truths?
Well, unity of knowledge is not in terms of propositions.
Okay.
You know, in fact, that's a big thing in religion. You have to get to the. First of all, I would from my point of view, almost all religion is part of the heart. Is, and the heart is without words.
But it's very difficult to talk about the heart, and we all know of examples where people's hearts, emotions lead them to do terrible things.
Certainly. The heart is the source of good and also the source of bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the methodology, in this way, I'm looking for the source of good. And in fact, a big thing in this book is to show that these people got internal, there's unity. There was unity and fulfillment. Because, our lives are very fragmented, unbelievably fragmented.
Yeah.
And here we have a situation where all four of the people that went on to get a PhD, to graduate school to get a PhD, all four of them, saw a higher aspect, and that higher aspect gave them that fulfillment.
Now, the path to that understanding isn't always easy, and you mentioned that even the two of these four graduate students you interviewed in depth did drop out for a while. Did both of them come back and actually finish the dissertation?
Yes.
Okay. Did this vision of the higher...
Well, I don't know whether he finished the dissertation, but he came back, certainly, and he's like graduate student.
Okay, still studying. And do you think that this understanding of the higher aspects of math helped them find direction?
Well, absolutely, but you must not think of it as this understanding of a higher aspect as if, there was one thing that they got or something like that.
Okay.
No, it was in one case it was very much, they're all like levels of inspiration, beauty, connected with ethics, connected with metaphysical things, and so on, the whole thing. In fact, that's why it's very difficult, because you have to show that it really played a very deep role in the person's life. It pulled them together. It pulled their inner vision together, so to speak.
And when you talk about ethics, do you think this kind of experience, this spiritual experience that was possible in this study of higher math, made them better people terms of ethics?
Yes.
What kind of evidence do you have of that? Of course, this is self-reporting, so it's often...
It's all self-reporting, of course.
Yeah.
But, you can see in their accounts of their life that they got together. They got their... They became focused and so on. In some case, for example, they would stand up for ethical aspects. One of them was very upset about the reputation of math in the schools. So she went out to the schools to try to teach them how you should look at math, and so on, different.
When you were talking with these people, would you have been able to discern if they were fooling you, if they were lying to you?
Certainly.
How do you know?
There's a complete trust and understanding, and you have a sense when you, I mean, you realize, for example, I needed to know if there was, you know, a not great aspect in the person's life. I don't want to particularly explore it in depth. I mean, there's no secret to how you get off, how you make wrong decisions, how you get off the track, you know. So I would always focus on the, you have to be aware of those things, and you have to be aware of the objective circumstances so you can make a judgment and so on. But see, I'm thinking that this is not, that this is a very, a fairly common phenomenon, and it's much part of a much bigger phenomenon. So one of my problems was, to what extent is this due to math, and what this, to extent is it due to just committing yourself to some subject?
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So the book does that too.
We're talking with Professor Klaus Witz on Keeping the Faith this afternoon, and encouraging people to call. We do have a caller on line number one. Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Hello. It seems that in any field of research, you have the problem of the researcher affecting the outcome, and it seems that that would be possibly a big issue here. How did you deal with that?
Very good question. In this approach, you know, the you have to go through all kinds of inner training that every question you ask, for example, is maximally free of presuppositions. You ask something just, you know, you, I mean, when you ask a person, you ask to a level, I mean, you ask so that it's completely natural, but no presuppositions. And then you always give a lot of different possibilities and things like this. There is absolutely a lot of special attention on that. I have troubles, for example, with my students. My students do not always do that, you know. So I can point out, I point out to my students, look, you said this, and then that gave the participant that idea and stuff like that. So all this stuff is going on. But, you know, the person will get confidence that she really can bring up anything. In fact, you need the person's total cooperation. The person has to research her own life, search, look into herself, look into her own life, and look for significant things that are related to what I'm after. And so the person knows she has complete freedom. So, you know, when that comes out, for example, you know, there will be all, there will be feeling, there will be spontaneity, there will be, you know, you can see the stream of consciousness, so to speak. And that will go on for a while until the energy flags, and only then do you bring in your own, some questions, some clarifications, stuff like that, and so on. But this is a big problem, and I think, you know, a lot of my graduate students have been having problems with that. But they're also learning, so.
Can you give us an example of a question, a type of question you would ask one of your people you're interviewing?
Very general, you know. How is it that you got into math?
Uh-huh.
Very, very general.
Uh-huh.
And then just work with, in a very general way. And then, you know, okay, well, I was really good at it or whatnot, or whatever, you know. And so, see, in this project, I saw a lot of other things. I saw, I mean, math is really a mystery. In fact, you know, the introduction to the book says the mystery of mathematics seen the, in the experience of undergraduates or something like this. Because everybody, if you want to be a math teacher, you'll be affected by math, you'll have a certain relationship to math, and all these relationships are very different, you know. So this business of seeing a higher aspect in math, it happened with this one student who's this middle school teacher whose portrait I wrote in the book, and it happened with all of the the people that went on to a PhD. And it happened to some but see, there were other people that were not that successful. At first, when I had the project, I thought I would try to get an idea of how that affected the whole spectrum of people. Could everybody get fulfillment through math, you know? Well, I found out that it's an impossible question. Out of the 20 teacher education students that I interviewed, mostly like four interviews or something like that, maybe four or five or six were really connected in some deeper level to math. And there was fulfillment at that level. But again, the type of fulfillment differs, for example, between if you're just looking at high school math or if you're looking at higher math.
In this kind of a study where you do these in-depth interviews, yes, for an hour, six or seven times, are they reproducible at all? Isn't that a requirement?
Tremendous,
isn't that a requirement for sort of scientific investigation?
Yes. I would say, you know, every sentence you write, remember you have a 40-page portrait. Every sentence you write, the reader can check that sentence against, you know, 10 pages of quotes that are part of those, or 15 pages of quotes that are part of the 40. And what you're saying, so every nuance has to be correct, so to speak. And there is an unbelievable consistency within a person, an unbelievable unity within each person, up to a certain level, of course. And so, you know, one of the things I discovered, that's true for everybody. But now for spiritual people, the unity is usually much higher.
Now, Professor, one thing that I'm thinking about is you're a nice person, and you've studied spirituality. You have this great interest in religion. You're very hopeful and optimistic, and you've selected people who, you know, you got along well with. And I'm wondering, from our last caller, my skeptical question would be: might your attitude have affected the study just in terms of who you selected to talk with?
The people were volunteers.
Yeah.
And they were, in fact, the graduate students, they were, you know, I talked to one person and he talked to other students and they contacted me, this uh-huh. sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we would have a coffee.
Right.
And I would tell them about my concerns,
okay,
and my interests,
right,
and so on.
Well, this type of study reminds me more of what Freud did in the last century in terms of you know, learning things in depth from specific people,
sure,
and then
okay,
finding that kind of thing illuminating and developed a whole philosophy from it, a whole point of view. What have you developed from this? What are some of your conclusions?
Well, number one, I would say there is definitely an inner connection. See, math has always been a mystery. What is math? What are you actually studying? There's a problem. There is definitely an inner connection between math and the spiritual side of a person. There's no question. That comes out at those levels. I would say that, I think, a fair proportion of mathematicians, you know, there's this adage that all mathematicians are Platonists. Now, being a Platonist already means you have some degree of faith.
At least a belief in the ideal forms, okay.
It cannot be expressed in words what this is.
Hmm. What other conclusions?
Well, I try to... I found these people are all fulfilled on an individual level. But, you know, the aspect of mathematics having a spiritual side and promoting that in undergraduates or something like that or in high school does not exist in education.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, virtually all the efforts in that project are not looked at in education. I mean, people pay lip service. You know, a president will say, yes, you know, an undergraduate is one who finds a direction in life and gets his trip together and becomes something in society. But what is involved, people don't look at it. And now, I mean, I think there is some kind of a movement that spirituality is a major factor in that. Student services people know about this kind of thing. On another level, the book is actually classified in the main subject classification is philosophy of mathematics, and the other one is science and religion. So it goes into all these things. Many mathematicians will tell you, people here in the math department have told me, you know, math is a religion.
Well, we've about run out of time, and our guest today on Keeping the Faith has been talking about spirituality and mathematics. His PhD was in mathematics from University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He joined the math department here 46 years ago, ended up in the Department of Education, in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction, and has been doing studies about mathematics as a way to involving spiritual aspirations, which is the part of the title of his most recently published book, just out this month. It's called Spiritual Aspirations Connected with Mathematics, The Experience of American University Students, published by Edwin Mellon. It's quite expensive. It's mainly sent to libraries, but Professor Witz has said if people are interested in getting a copy at his extreme discount of about $40, they may email him at kwitz, K-W-I-T-Z, at uiuc.edu, and he'll communicate with you about how to get a copy of the book. Thanks to our callers, and thanks to Professor Witz for talking about spirituality and mathematics. Coming up here next week, we'll be talking with Claude Shelby about the interesting scholarship programs here for minority students in Champaign-Urbana, sponsored by the Martin Luther King Committee and the Martin Luther King Celebration at Krannert Center. The Great Hall will be January 20 at 5 o'clock. Also on Keeping the Faith that day will be Michael Ledoux reading his poetry. Climate change will be the topic here on Keeping the Faith January 27th with Carolyn Treadway, who was trained by Al Gore to discuss things about climate change. And, of course, he knows a lot about it. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Smoking cigarettes is bad for you. So why are 20% of us still smoking? That's 60 million Americans. And new ones start every day. It's more than just nicotine. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll explore the sublime pleasures of taking a puff. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana.
Did the framers of the U.S. Constitution believe that America was a Christian nation, or were they secularists who believed in the separation of church and state? John DiIulio says that both sides of this conflict are built on myth. Monday morning on Focus 580, we'll talk with DiIulio about his new book, Godly Republic. He uses it to argue for a middle way, one that recognizes the importance of faith while at the same time respecting religious pluralism. I'm David Inge, the host. It's Focus 580, Monday morning at 11, here on WILL Urbana.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a chance of rain after midnight. The low in the mid-50s with south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of rain, unseasonably warm with a high in the mid-60s. Breezy with south winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, rain and a chance of thunderstorms, the low in the lower 50s. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.